Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, January 24, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the future of the free enterprise system. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please remember that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, I'm very pleased to welcome Arthur C. Brooks, who is the president of the American Enterprise Institute, as our presenter and expert. He's a prolific writer, the author of 8 books and many articles, including the book that will be the primary focus of his discussion today, The Road to Freedom, How to Win the Fight for Free Enterprise. A link to that book, to the Amazon website page of that book, was provided to you in the notice of today's call, and it's also available on the Federalist Society's website. So too was more biographical information on Dr. Brooks, so I'm going to stop my introduction there. He's going to speak to us for about 10 to 15 minutes of opening remarks, after which we're going to turn to the audience for questions. So with that, Dr. Brooks, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be with all of you and to work with the Federalist Society on our toward our mutual goals of a better, freer America, which enriches the world. I think we all would agree, and I think that we all see that the present policy climate that we face is one of danger to those goals. And so working together between AEI and the Federalist Society is something that gives me a great deal of satisfaction. Thanks again for inviting me. You asked me to come today to talk about my latest book, The Road to Freedom, and I'm delighted to do that and extend the remarks to what I've been talking about with policymakers over the last few weeks since the election. And the reason that I'm going to extend the remarks a little bit is because I think that the policy climate is different than what it was last summer when I published the book, and I want to make this as relevant as possible. In a nutshell, what I'll say over the next 15 minutes is that the problem that the conservative movement has today, in my view, is that it is insufficiently interested in morality. Now, that's a kind of a strange thing to say, potentially, because there are a lot of people on the political right who are awfully interested in morality. So I need to be a little bit more specific. The case that I'm going to make is that those of us that are primarily interested in free enterprise and free markets need to primarily be moralists, and only secondarily should we be making material arguments for the superiority of the free enterprise system. And only in so doing are we going to win the big debates of the day. We're very close to being so far down the road to social democracy that it will be difficult or impossible to turn the corner on getting back toward many of the founding ideals. I think many of the people on this call would agree with that. Perhaps if you don't, you'll let me know when we go to the remarks period. What we all should agree that we need is a better narrative, a better set of arguments on how to win the debates of the day, because we're simply not winning enough. So let's start there, and talk about the real paradox that we see in the American economy today. On the one hand, when you ask people if they believe that the free enterprise system is the best system for America's economy, despite severe ups and downs, right now, if you go ask the American people, do you believe that the free enterprise system is best, 70% will say yes, it's superior to all alternatives, despite the recession. I mean, this is an incredibly large majority will say that it's the best system. And if you ask the American people in reputable surveys about their view about government, they will tell you in about equal proportions, 70% will say that they think the government is too big and trying to do too much. So by all rights, the free enterprise movement should be winning every political debate, that the politicians that share a point of view should be winning the election, that Barack Obama should have been defeated. assuming you believe that his views are antithetical to the statistics that I just cited. So, but he won. So something's gone wrong. And to identify that, we need to resolve this paradox. Why people say that, but they've started to lose. And the paradox actually gets, the plot thickens, as they say. The paradox gets even more complicated when we consider the following fact. It's not just the last election that did damage to the strength of the viewpoint of people in the free enterprise movement. On the contrary, things have been moving towards social democracy in the United States for many years. If you go back to the year that the American Enterprise Institute was founded in 1938, you found that the founders of our organization were outraged by the fact that 15% of America's GDP was going to some level of government. Well, today, it's 39%. And according to the Congressional Budget Office, in the year 2038, 50% of America's GDP will go to state, local, or federal government. And that, you know, when you think about that, that means that every one of us, or all of us together in the United States, will work collectively from January 1st through June 30th to pay for a government that 80% of Americans say they don't like and they don't trust. So this is a deep, deep rift. On the one hand, we say we hold certain values. On the other hand, we elect government officials and we select government policies that do grievous harm to the principles that we say we espouse. So how do we resolve this paradox? And a lot of people have tried to do so, to try to explain why we see these contradictions. And there's kind of a liberal explanation and a conservative explanation, and I think that both are incorrect. So first, the liberal explanation is that we don't really love free enterprise as American people. We just say we do. We're sentimental about the idea of free markets and the Horatio Alger story and the man who, in the words of Thomas Jefferson when describing the prototypical American, said it's a man who moves west the first day he hears the sound of his neighbor's axe. We still like that kind of 19th century Protestant view of the American pioneer. But in reality, I mean, we say we like that, but in reality what we want is the government to pay for a cradle-to-grave welfare state. That's the prevailing view of people in a lot of academia and in the media, that what we really truly want is a social welfare state. And when we get that, then we'll be happy. Well, the conservative view that explains the paradox is that we've been insufficiently detailed in our description of what's going wrong in our economy, that we need to have more facts and figures about what it takes to fiscally consolidate and get rid of debt and jumpstart economic growth. And then when Americans see how big the debt actually gets, you know, how many zeros are on the debt or racking up on the debt clock, then finally they'll wake up and finally they'll turn toward free enterprise. And I know that is explanation for the paradox is false, because as the president of the American Enterprise Institute, I can assure everybody listening that I have lots of data, and that's not doing the trick. The explanation, as far as I'm concerned, that is most compelling is that we have failed to make a moral case for our point of view. A moral case is one that all people find most compelling, and a material case is only secondary. The left in America for a long time has been much better at instinctively making moral cases than we have, even though we feel them, and there's some irony in that. The political left in America is fundamentally materialist. It's secularist, and it has social democratic leanings, both of which are both philosophically and economically based on the concepts of materialism. Yet they wrap their arguments in moral language. We, on the other hand, are primarily moralists. We believe that a free society is a good. Many of us believe that these are natural rights that they proceed from, that these are the moral ideas of our founders, yet we wrap our arguments in materialistic language about GDP growth, about the unemployment rate, about the dangers of inflation. And the result is that people reject the materialistic arguments but ultimately get the materialistic policies. This is why 80% of Americans are unsatisfied. They think that we're going in the wrong direction despite the fact that they're clinging to the policies that are on offer from the left. So how do we resolve this? And the answer is we need to learn to make a moral argument, and that's what a lot of my writing has been about, a lot of the work that we do at AEI is about, and not just to make an emotional argument, but rather a real moral argument. There's a lot of research that's happened over the past 10 years about moral judgments. The best scholar currently, most compellingly writing about this subject, is a social psychologist at the Stern School of Business at NYU. His name is Jonathan Haidt, which for those of you who recognize the name, it will be because he had a big bestseller last year called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Disagree on Politics and Religion. And Jonathan Haidt, over the past 10 years, has interviewed directly or indirectly 117,000 Americans about their moral viewpoints. And he finds some fascinating things. The principal finding of his research is that there are five moral pillars. And of these, that people coalesce around, their moral values come in five baskets, basically. Two of them are shared by basically 100% of the population, and three of them are not. So the two that are most interesting because they're shared by so many people are, number one, that fairness is a critical moral value. It is immoral to behave unfairly. That cronyism and corruption from government are unfair, that a boss who is arbitrary and capricious and passing out favors or bonuses or raises is unfair, that a parent who favors one child over the other is unfair. And this morally offends us. There's a kind of a natural, visceral reaction we have against unfairness. And almost the whole population agrees on these, on the fundamental idea. The devil in the details here is how we define fairness. We'll get to that in a second. The second fundamental pillar of morality, shared by about 100% of the population, regards vulnerable people. That most, virtually everybody in America would agree with you if you said, it's good to help vulnerable people and it's bad to hurt them. Now, I know that sounds completely obvious, but that's what makes it 100% moral value. It's actually quite unusual when societies would reject that moral value, and it's almost always because authoritarian rulers have been able to change the sense of conscience that happens within countries. It appears to be almost hardwired that people have a moral value of helping the vulnerable. Okay, so those are the two 100% moral values. There are others that are shared by smaller groups, and the interesting thing from the research is that the three other moral values that we find generally are shared by only about 30% of the population, and those 30% are political conservatives. So political liberals have not necessarily worse values or improper values, but they have fewer moral values than conservatives do, according to this research by Haidt. The three that conservatives have that liberals don't are, number one, that respect for authority is naturally a good thing. Liberals and moderates, they question that. They don't think that you shouldn't respect authority, but they would only respect authority if authority commands respect or deserves respect. Whereas conservatives, typically in most of the surveys, you find that the respect for authority per se is a good thing. Similarly, conservatives say that loyalty to a group is a good thing, and liberals question that. And finally, personal purity or sanctity, particularly in matters of sex, is something that conservatives hold and that liberals question in very large numbers. So basically, you can make moral arguments that appeal to 100% of the population if you talk about helping the vulnerable or acting fairly, or you can make a moral argument that appeals to 30% of the population if you talk about respect for authority, loyalty to the group, or sexual purity. Okay, now, this leads us to ask the question. If we want to make a compelling argument, we know it must be based principally in morality. Two, the kind of argument that will be most compelling to the most people must revolve around either basic fairness or help for the vulnerable. And this turns the key in the lock on how we need to be talking about free enterprise and, in general, a free society. Too often, when we're talking about our current political debates about policies of the day, we as political conservatives, some of you I'm sure consider yourselves political conservatives, as do I, we get stuck in the 30% category when we could be convincing far, far more people with the moral arguments that are in the 100% category. Or we make the basic error of making the materialistic argument. Those are the two big argument errors that we tend to see on the right. So how do we make these types of arguments? Well, number one, thinking about always, you know, following the rule, find the vulnerable party and fight for him. That's the debate principle component when it comes to finding and helping the vulnerable. Don't fight against something, fight for someone. There are all kinds of case studies that show when we've lost debates because we failed to follow this particular principle. For example, the Health and Human Services mandate, which came out when the Obama administration imposed on employers that they must purchase insurance that covers contraceptives and abortifacient drugs. Immediately, the argument that came from the the conservative media, from pundits in the conservative media, was that this was an immoral attempt to incentivize promiscuous sexual activity. The famous Sandra Fluke case, a Georgetown law student, was all about, isn't it wrong and stupid and unfair that we have to pay for somebody's indecency? The problem is that was a 30% moral argument. 70% of America basically rolled its collective eyes at the puritanism of the religious right. And the Obama administration, after winning that argument, went in for the kill by labeling that a war on women, which took the 100% moral argument of finding and fighting for the vulnerable. So in other words, we should have won that debate. If you agree with me that it was tyranny in the HHS case, we should have won the debate by finding the vulnerable, which is to say religious people of conscience having their consciences violated by government edict. Instead, the spokespeople, unappointed at that, made it about sex, which is a 30% issue, and handed the 100% moral issue over to the Obama administration. My bottom line is this, and I can go into any more detail anybody wants, but I need to stop, I think, so we have enough time, is simply to say there are case after case after case of the left talking about fairness inappropriately and us failing to make our own case for fairness or the vulnerable, and as a result, losing many of the debates of the day. And I'll leave it at that.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Brooks. Let's open the lines to questions from the audience. While we're waiting for the audience to ring in here, let me make a programming announcement about our teleforum calls that are scheduled, at least so far, next week. Next Tuesday, the 29th, we'll have a call on the greenhouse gas litigation. That'll be Tuesday at 12 noon at this same number. On Thursday at 2 p.m., we'll have a call talking about class action litigation and the food manufacturers. So with that, it looks like we've got two folks with questions so far. Let's go to our first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. As a veteran of this struggle for many decades, I found that it's all very well and good to make various moral appeals, but the devil is in the details. And very often, a moral appeal backed by a detailed proposal that subverts that value will actually prevail, simply because those who only got as far as the moral values did not examine the detailed proposals. So I would recommend you consider that no one should make any moral value decisions without examining the details and working out how they affect very complex systems.
No, I agree. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, and the battlefield is a field of law. Many laws or legal doctrines are sold on the basis of usually both of the first two that you mentioned, but then it becomes subverted by reliance interests, who then take it in a direction that the proponents, the advocates, would not recognize. And I'm afraid that at this point, they become so entrenched that the only way we're going to be able to back off from this situation is with constitutional amendments, because we have too many, to reverse all the precedents that entrench the corruption in place would take at least 60 years and a total cultural revolution of the legal profession.
Dr. Brooks, you care to respond?
Sure. I agree that it's going to take a long time. And under the best of circumstances, it's going to take a long time. If you look at the data, the road to serfdom that we've been on has lasted a long time. I mean, the two big misconceptions about what's been going on in the areas of free enterprise, let alone all the other areas that are either vaguely or what a lot of us would believe to be overtly unconstitutional, these number one, the misconception is that this is really just the work of the Obama administration. Just take that. The truth of the matter is we've been working, or I guess the misconception number two is that we're tending toward becoming European-style social democracy. In the first case, it's been 75 years that the free enterprise system has been systematically subverted, at least. And number two, we already are a European-style social democracy. No matter how you measure it, we are there. We are every bit as social democratic economically as any of our European friends. So 60 years is actually a lot less time, or substantially less time, than we've spent getting where we are right now. And it's going to take absolutely a multi-pronged effort that is legal, that is moral, purely moral, appealing to the sentiments, to the better moral sentiments of the American public. It's going to be political. It's going to have to be economic. That's why all of us who are in different particular fields, everybody from lawyers to economists who are of the same basic conscience, are going to have to take on the tools that we have. Now, the earlier comment that you just made is really important, too, which is that it's very easy to make a sort of a basic moral pronouncement, and then the details of it can be orthogonal to the morality that you state from the outset. That describes in a nutshell what's gone on with the Obama administration. Just give you the most recent case. The Obama administration, in the name of helping the victims of the recession, raised taxes on a lot of people on this call, raised the marginal federal income tax rate for a lot of people on this call, so that they could help people in the recession, suffering from the recession. Okay, now, forget the fact that we're all economically savvy enough to know that that's pure and utter nonsense. That's a terrible argument. As a philosophical principle, we understand what Obama was trying to do, but practically speaking, after that moral pronouncement of the right thing to do philosophically, 80% of the money in the same bill went out the back door into the hands of corporate cronies who were friends of the administration. 80%. Producers of goods and services in American Samoa, rum producers, community organizers, wind farmers, algae producers. Of the $62 billion a year in new revenues that's coming from you on this call, $50 billion are going to corporate cronies. That is to say, Obamanomics in a nutshell is based on false moral pronouncements and, practically speaking, is geared toward taking money from rich makers and giving it to rich takers. That is a perfect example of the principle articulated in this first comment.
Let's go to our next caller.
Karen Lugo from Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence. Trying to make a moral argument regarding foreign policy for years and just studying the different kind of response that Americans would receive some of the various conflicts or our response to them over years has taught me, I think more than anything, that we go through a filter of a media that is hostile to the arguments we want to make. And going back to your example of Sandra Fluck, we're looking at constructs where on one hand there's an emphasis on personal responsibility for decisions and behavior, and a church that the public might perceive imposes or dictates that, versus immediate gratification and avoidance of consequences, et cetera, et cetera. So even though you're talking, framing things in terms of morality and maybe the more sympathetic personality, it's still, our arguments still go through the filter of a media that is hostile to the essential concerns about virtue and consequences that conservatives have to make.
You're right. You're correct. We've always fought this. Brent Bozell knows this better than anybody about what the consequences are of having a completely hostile media. But that's nothing new. This has been going on for the longest time. If anything, times are better because we have so many alternative forms of getting messages out to people who share conscience with us, those of us who consider ourselves political conservatives or libertarians. you know, there the means of communication that we have simply didn't exist 20 and 30 years ago, back when, you know, Walter Cronkite was a leftist and was considered to be, you know, right down the middle because this was really the only thing on offer. So things have gotten better, but it is also the case, the biggest problem that we have had, that we had in the November election, in my view, and it is that not that the media was suddenly distorting things more than they had, because the media was doing what the media does. I mean, the media is biased liberal. This is not breaking news, as it were. What the real difference was that we had a whole lot of national candidates that were basically not even trying to make the moral case. When we think about it, the political leaders who agree with us about the free enterprise system and the value, the moral value of a free society, who've been most successful, they've done so in spite of the media. Ronald Reagan was incredibly successful. He had a hostile media. They hated him. But he made appeals to the American public that basically said, I believe in the same things that you believe in about a better society, about basic fair play, about working an honest day and getting an honest day's wage. I mean, he used that kind of language about fairness being merit and opportunity and rewarding hard work, about actually looking out for Americans and to address the point you made about national security. The idea of the basic vulnerability about people around the world who are struggling for the kind of freedoms that we enjoy in the United States as well. The moral case can get past a lot of bias. I wish there were no bias at all, but it's something we still have to deal with.
All right, let's go to our next caller. Hi, Dr. Brooks. This is Evan Bullock from Phoenix, Arizona. And I think your last comment segue really well into my question, which is what politicians that are currently out there on the conservative or libertarian side are willing to embrace your message? Because I do feel that most of the politicians that we have on the national scale, especially Mitt Romney, did act with disdain and without empathy or putting forth, you know, this great ethical view that you're espousing. So is there anyone out there who is willing to to put forth, you know, these arguments that you've expressed in this call today?
Yeah, I see it more and more. So there's a couple of pieces of good news as I see it. You know, working, as I'm privileged to do, with a lot of leaders on the Hill and here in Washington, D.C. The first piece of good news is a lot of people who sat out major leadership position races in this last election are not going to sit it out in the future. There are people like Jeb Bush and Bobby Jindal and I don't know about Mitch Daniels, but you know, Paul Ryan taking a different kind of approach that could hold real promise. I mean, there are probably people on this call wish that different people had been running. And we're going to see, I think there's every indication so far that we're going to see some of these people, as well as some of the national governors who've made these cases very persuasively, people like Scott Walker, who've been extremely persuasive and that they're going to throw their hat in the ring for national politics. That's number one. That's sort of piece of good news number one. Piece of good news number two is that the leitmotif, I think, over the next 2 and 4 years on the right is going to be much, much more geared toward helping the vulnerable in this country. And that is the natural legacy and patrimony of the political right. It is simply the case that we are the warriors for the poor and vulnerable, not the rich and the powerful. If you look at any definition of what we've done, everything from standing up for individual charity to spreading free enterprise around the world and pulling literally billions of people out of poverty, to the kind of reforms that we've tried to make that ultimately would reform welfare and pull people out of generations of dependency, we are the warriors for the poor. And the fact that they've been able to wrap themselves in this argument of being the advocates for the poor, whereas liberal, particularly great society policies, have done the worst damage to the culture of poverty that we could possibly imagine, is really a crime. And it's not a crime for anybody on this call. It's a crime against poor people. That, I believe, this is the good news, that that's going to change. And I'm already I have the opportunity, probably my next book will be The Conservative War on Poverty. It will be how we can be quite consciously the warriors for the bottom 20% and the bottom 50% of the population to turn this thing around such that people understand that it is written on our hearts, that this is what we must do morally, and that we base the philosophy of our movement on that which impelled virtually all of our ancestors to come to the United States, which was not in search of a better system of forced income redistribution, but rather a truly fair system that would give them a fair break in exchange for their hard work and merit for the very first time in their lives. So there's a lot to be done there. Early indications are that we will make, I think, real strides in the next 2 and 4 years.
If you have a question for Dr. Brooks, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We have one more caller question at this point, and then our lines are open. So push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to the next caller.
Dr. Brooks, thank you. This is Jack Park, a lawyer in Atlanta. This may go kind of counter to your last comment, but take Head Start. It would appear that the vulnerable are the people it's helping, except it's not helping them.
Right.
How would you make a case that with respect to something that's just a complete, that might be considered a complete, total, unambiguous waste of money?
When we make a policy argument where you see something that looks like a boondoggle, but a big-hearted boondoggle, the best way to lose the debate and look like a bad person in the process is to zero it out and offer nothing in exchange. What we really need to do is always have an alternative in mind. In other words, just being a budget cutter is good if you want to be the chairman of OMB. It's not good enough if you're trying to win policy victories on behalf of the most vulnerable citizens. In other words, I've seen the data myself on Head Start, and I agree that it's just they're very depressing, the data on the effectiveness of that program and many other anti-poverty programs. Do we have any solution? Do we have any alternatives? The answer is yes. Education innovation is arguably the most exciting area of policy analysis today. I mean, this is the reason that Jeb Bush is such a political growth stock. He understands that being a warrior for the poor starts with a revolutionary attitude about innovation and education and the uncompromising moral stance that education systems should be designed to help students and not adults. You know, just based on those two basic ideas, he's been able to float some very, very good ideas, some really promising things that can help poor people and middle-class people and everybody else in between. And if we can come up with the best ideas and we can champion them, we can have people who are our champions in these areas and say, don't do that. It's not helping them. It's taking money that should be going to this, and this will really help the poor. That makes you sound like you care so much about the poor that you don't want to waste money and time doing something that doesn't work.
Thank you.
We've got another caller question, Dr. Brooks. After that, our lines are open. Before we go to that next caller, let me ask, you alluded to your next book. Your current book, of course, is available at Amazon.com and bookstores. Do you have a time frame for publication of your next book?
Yeah, let's just say that my publisher has a time frame for my next book. Running an organization makes those things complicated. But in principle, sometime at the end of 2014 or the beginning of 2015, assuming all goes well, we should be seeing more work from AEI and from me personally on these ideas.
All right. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines will be open after this next caller.
Yes, thank you. This is Bob Davis in Portland, Maine. In response to the previous question, you started to get into the thing that I thought you were missing, and that's the whole area of education. You know, we try to convince in our campaigns, we try to undo, really, an entire education that the voters have brought to the campaign, and we're trying to do that through the filter of the media. Do you have any ideas on how you fundamentally change, to coin someone else's, use someone else's word, the educational system in the country to better reflect the more traditional values? And, of course, there's a lot of talk about when I was teaching, never teach values, that type of thing, just
right.
Values clarification. But trying to get back to not trying to beat them into someone's head, but at least to give them the options of seeing which values are preferable, and not only which are preferable, but why they're preferable, what they lead to. In my state, for example, in Maine, education is a tremendous issue, and you can run on that and say you're for education, and that will do wonders for you. But it's
right.
Also a very, very hostile state to business. And yet the people here want their kids to grow up and get a good job in the state of Maine. And yet no politician connects the fact that in order for that to happen, the kids to get a good education and then to stay in the state of Maine, you have to have a job for them to go to. And with a hostile business environment, that's never going to happen. And yet that's the way they continue to vote. So I just wonder if you have further thoughts on that.
Yeah, for sure. Now, one of the things that we've found is that fundamental change that improves industries for the benefit of consumers. So just speaking as an industrial organization economist for a minute, those things only occur when you break cartels. The most damaging thing that comes from monopoly is high price, scarcity, low quality, and rent seeking. Those are the effects of every monopoly we've ever seen that suffocates competition. Okay, so that in a nutshell is what's wrong with the education system. So we say that we want education that serves to educate kids and college students with more points of view, for example, or simply more traditional values, or reflects the values of parents. I mean, these are the kinds of complaints that we typically hear. That is another way of saying that these markets are not serving what the consumers actually want. The reason for that are the barriers to entry and the barriers to innovation. The best way to break up a monopoly is not, you know, it's not the invocation of necessarily of antitrust law, although that's really necessary, and some of you are involved in that. That's a good thing. But the single most effective way to wreck a monopoly is by lowering the barriers to entry through innovation. That's the way to do it, and that's exactly the reason that teaching cartels, that education cartels are so unbelievably hostile to innovation. It weakens the ability to keep a stranglehold on the education system such that that disproportionately benefits adults as opposed to children. And that, in a nutshell, is what we're really concerned about. So that's why not talking about beating up these thuggish teachers' unions, although that's a fun thing to do, not talking about that, but rather being an advocate and a warrior for children and saying the best way that we can do it is providing new kinds of education mechanisms, just like every other business has seen, to bring education into the 21st century, kind of like Jeb Bush and other reformers talk about it, is a very subversive way to get the same point across. And this gets back to an earlier point that I made. Don't attack something. Fight for someone. And in the case of educational reform, we've had a tendency to say, you know, the problem with our education system are these thugs, the teachers' unions, and these ineffective bureaucrats who are sucking up all the resources. You know, 52% of the California General Fund goes to an education system that systematically underserves the bottom 20% of the population. It's a scandal, right? Now, what do the left say? Why are you beating up on our hardworking teachers and our hardworking civil servants? They identify the victim, and they walk off of the debate. Start fighting for the kids and providing a solution to how we can serve the kids better by using the innovation that will reward entrepreneurs and bring entrepreneurship into the system. That, in my view, is the solution that will get all of these other good knock-on effects coming. Values, diversity, a better set of higher educational outcomes. These things will, I think that's what we could expect, and we'd all welcome it.
Could I get a follow-up to that?
Go right ahead.
Yeah, but you've got to have someone who is willing to take advantage of a situation. I'm thinking of the voucher system in D.C. The Democrats killed that system, which was demonstrably a system that worked, helped mostly the more downtrodden, that is, blacks in the District of Columbia. And yet, do the Republicans ever beat their chests about that, make a big deal about it, to restore the funding, to retain the system, and even spread the system to other areas? Well, the answer is obvious. No, they did not. So the Democrats were able to go right after the most vulnerable, take away the opportunities that at least some of them had for a real improvement in their lives, and the Republicans sat there dumb.
Yeah, well, the Republicans didn't make the moral case to stand up for the vulnerable. I mean, the Republicans were kind of angry about the fact that the teachers' unions did something that was so, you know, brutish and selfish. But instead of, you know, the war for children, they made a different argument, and it died out because it didn't really have a very big constituency. Now, there's good news on that, but it's only dumb luck. The good news is that, I mean, we've been working with the D.C. public schools for a really long time with both Republicans and Democrats, mostly Democrats in D.C., as you can imagine. And there's a chancellor of the D.C. public schools named Kaya Henderson, who's a liberal Democrat, but a real reformer. And after the school vouchers or the school choice issue, she quietly has been moving charters into the position that the other schools were taking, and the result is that more than half of public school students in the District of Columbia now attend charters. So there are other ways around this. We need to be thinking really creatively, once again, about ways that the children can be served. And this is you can apply all of these particular concepts to any of the basic policy debates of the day. If you're kid-focused as opposed to focused on the particular methodology, then you won't be fighting against something but rather for someone, and that's the key to success in my view.
Thank you. The Republicans need to find a way to get the credit for doing something like that. In that case, they will not. And if they are not more articulate, outspoken, and do what needs to be done, they never will get credit for it, and they need that in order to bring around those people who presently are not voting for them because they see them as kind of, you know, a bunch of nasty people who are just interested in their own self-interest. Thank you.
Agreed. Agreed. You are correct.
Three questions.
Good advice, and I'll continue to give it.
Well, Dr. Brooks, we've got three questions pending now. We'll go to the next caller.
Dr. Brooks, Leo Dombrowski, Society member in Chicago. How would you suggest that we talk about the national debt and deficits? It's easy for Obama and the administration to say that, you know, there's a lot of people out there, the vulnerable people, they need a monthly check, they need a bunch of other free stuff. It's a very easy argument for them to make. It's immediate. People understand it. On the other hand, conservatives say adding more than $1 trillion every year to the national debt is not sustainable. One of these days, it's going to lead to the destruction of the dollar, runaway inflation. That's kind of an abstract, vague argument. People hear, they reject it. They say, well, that may or may not happen. It's not happening now. How do we make our case in better terms so that people do understand how precarious the situation is?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, the problem is that the arguments on our side have been hijacked by economists like me. You know, everything is in dollar and cents terms. You know, do you realize that the current policies could lead to a permanent 0.25 percentage point decline in economic growth? I mean, people just shrug their shoulders. You know, who cares? You know, that's not even... It might be right. I just don't really care. It means nothing to me. The key thing is that they are putting up their victim against our materialistic data. That's why we lose, and you're exactly right in the way that you diagnose the problem. And the answer to that is we care about this not because we care about inflation per se. I don't care about inflation per se. I care about the way inflation affects people. I don't care about the effects of, you know, the dollar no longer being the reserve currency of the world just because it's some sort of national pride. I couldn't care less. I care because it actually affects people when these things happen. So we got to start talking about the people that are affected by this. And predominantly when we're talking about the accumulation of year after year trillion-dollar deficits adding up to debt, you know, the apparent obvious debt that's just sitting on the books of $16 or $17 trillion right now, plus all of the unfunded liabilities, the reason that we really care about this is that we are stealing from our children. We're stealing from them. That's number one. I mean, put a face on this. Your kids. You know, the most effective thing that congressmen can possibly do is to attribute the best motives to senior citizens when they talk at a senior center. Say, I know none of you want to pass a debt on to your grandchildren. just saying that neutralizes a huge amount of opposition they would naturally get from seniors when they want to talk about the reform of entitlements. They're not going to get smooth sledding, but the point is actually making this moral argument that will buff off a lot of these raw edges that simply talking about numbers wouldn't. That's number one. Number two is talking about who's affected when we wreck our economy. If you go to Western Europe today, if you go to the periphery economies, I mean, I lived in Spain for a long time. A lot of you have spent some, you know, time in these countries as well. You know that homelessness is at an all-time high in the periphery economies, by far. I mean, an all-time, you know, post-war high in these economies. So what's going on? And the answer is, when an economy is destroyed, rich people are inconvenienced. Middle-class people are frightened. Poor people become homeless and hungry. That's the truth of the matter. We are actually in the process of creating a system that puts our vulnerable people most at risk. Throw it back in the face of the liberals. Not everybody is going to believe it, but at least we're making the case on their behalf because it's the right thing to do, number one. And number two, this is everybody in America knows it's not right to steal from our kids. You know, why did we lose the cash for clunkers debate? That was basically... that was arguing that it was going to, it was somehow okay for us to make our children pay for our new cars. I mean, in rather stark terms, it's so preposterous that it doesn't even pass the laugh test, let alone the moral outrage test. So, bottom line, put faces on these things. Talk about real people and the effects on real identifiable individuals. That goes toe to toe with the liberals.
We've got two callers with questions remaining. Let's go to the next caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org, back. When I was in public school, most of my classmates were involved in their family business. They grew up in the family business. They learned economics that way. They learned entrepreneurship that way. Some of them learned something about law that way and government when government impinged on their business. That's lacking today. I've done some substitute teaching, and none of the students had any experience with small business except the ones they were dealing drugs. And it seems that if we're going to reform education, what we possibly need to do is put kids on a track, starting with year one, on how to start a business, how to run a business, how to deal with legal problems in a business, how to deal with governmental problems with a business, but keep the focus on some kind of productive activity, which could be actual businesses that the kids start up.
Dr. Brooks, you want to respond?
Sure. I mean, that's great. That's fantastic. It's good advice, and I completely agree with it. We're working right now with workforce development agencies here in Washington, D.C., people who serve the very poor in Washington and are tangentially involved in the workforce or not at all because of mental health or substance abuse or criminal background or whatever. And we're working with them on what people actually need to be productive members of the workforce. So you're talking about kids and college students getting more entrepreneurial acumen so that they are better prepared to embrace what America's got to offer, and then consequently they'll be more interested in fighting for it down the line. But let's move downstream a little bit to the very poor. One of the things that we find is that the most effective people at pulling themselves out of poverty are not starting businesses necessarily, but they have an entrepreneurial orientation about their lives. And so what we're working on with these workforce development organizations is to talk about what the entrepreneurial values are and working that into life advice for these people who are very poor. People, the entrepreneurial orientation is not all or nothing. You're not just a business starter or not. You can be more entrepreneurial or less. And this kind of advice is turning out to have really interesting implications for the way that people can be helped. Partly it's because it's a fundamental American value to build your own life, not just to build your own business. And entrepreneurs, I can tell you, are the people who are most sympathetic to the idea of limited government, of the government staying out of the way of the individual decisions, of being able to hold our own values. And this is the natural constituency for Republican or Democrat, for a culture of liberty. So I think this is one of the ways, exactly what you say, but all the way down the food chain, to the poorest of the poor, in trying to impart these values to everybody with potentially high gains.
All right. Somehow we still have two questions left. We've got 8 or 9 minutes. I promised Dr. Brooks we'd end it a couple minutes early, so if the callers could make their questions as brief as possible, we'll try and get through these final two questions.
I'll get through my question. My answer is fit fast, too.
Yes, Dr. Brooks, David Emerson, society member here in Berkeley. My question for you has to do with, in terms of advocating for the free market and free enterprise, do you believe that, we, on our side of our issue, on the pro free enterprise argument, that we have a responsibility to also lay out what reasonable limits there ought to be on that so that we don't leave that job to the opposition, which is going to color that and paint that in a much more dire way? So to the effect that there are excesses of the free market, and is it our job in a reasonable manner?
It's a great question. It's one I've thought an awful lot about. I've got a piece coming out in the journal National Affairs on that very topic sometime in the next couple of months. And it's the piece basically says, we all love free markets, but free markets are not the same thing as free enterprise. If you believe Adam Smith or even Friedrich Hayek, who both talked about the fact that markets can and do fail, and under certain circumstances, that's exactly why we have the state. Not to mention the fact that, as Hayek reminds us, I mean, Hayek, the iconic, most important conservative economist of the 20th century, reminds, or libertarian economist of the 20th century, reminds us that one of the first jobs in a civilized society is, even if it creates a headwind on economic efficiency, it's entirely legitimate to have a social safety net for the truly indigent. What's cancerous for a society is a social safety net for the middle class, for corporations, for the rich, and for the 70% of Americans who currently take more out of the tax system than they pay into it, which is really what's taking us down to use Hayek's language, right down the road to serfdom. So you're exactly right. We have to talk about the fact that markets can and do fail, and there are sometimes cost-beneficial reasons for the government to be involved. That's the reason that we need a constitution. That's the reason that we need a legal profession. And it's the reason that we need people who can adjudicate some of these issues in an economically literate but also a legally coherent way. And furthermore, that we should not be the people who say we need to get rid of the social safety net for the truly indigent. On the contrary, what we should be doing is patrolling the boundaries so that the line between relief and opportunity doesn't become so blurred that we can destroy the lives of poor people and make them dependent no matter how hard they work. So absolutely we should talk about market failures. We should talk about the fact that we need law, not just markets. And together with these things, we espouse our true values. I mean, constitutionally limited government and free enterprise, these are not the ends in themselves. These are the things that serve to protect the underlying values that we cherish so much. And that's why it's important that we talk about all angles.
Also address this issue of creative destruction in the job marketplace, and that jobs aren't necessarily for a lifetime, that there is a rapid turnover of jobs and skills, and it's not something that we ought to fear, something that perhaps we should embrace.
Absolutely we should, and a greater more entrepreneurial orientation among policymakers, leaders, and citizens will help us to be able to accommodate to that. The most rigid economic societies in the world are those where people have the least entrepreneurial orientation and consequently are least able to be flexible in the case of structural changes to the economy.
All right, we're running short on time, but let's get to this last question.
Hi, it's Jim Markowski in New York City. How do we deal with the problem of insane, irrational regulation, basically criminalizing people who start their own business and entrepreneurs? I'm sending out reminders to my clients that they have to give all their employees an annual notice telling them when and how much they're being paid. And that's even if the person has a one-person corporation. And there are countless examples of regulations that most businesses aren't aware of, they don't comply with, and then can get snared up and suddenly inadvertently become lawbreakers. It undercuts entrepreneurship.
Yeah, you sure have that right. Now, here's where it really becomes even more morally troublesome than the cases that you raise. I'm entirely sympathetic to your clients and to everybody on this call when it comes to the way that our own personal entrepreneurship is abrogated by the overregulated society. But here's where it gets even worse. The truth of the matter is that since the beginning of the Obama administration, business startups for the bottom 20% of the income distribution have fallen two-thirds below the historical average at this point in a recession. This is not because of the recession. This is because of the current regulatory environment, and I'm talking about the poor. Generally speaking, the poor who are 9 months or more unemployed, about 11% of them will start their own businesses, a non-trivial number of which will be successful. This is the way that the American economy, from the bottom end, rises like a phoenix from the ashes. That's being destroyed by current policy. So what policies? We're talking about occupational and licensing requirements, uncertain and onerous regulations for the startup of businesses, an uncertain tax environment, and simply the complication of knowing what to do. About half of the people in the bottom 20% of the income distribution don't even have access to the internet. The Obama administration is quite simply anti-poor when it comes to the tools of being fully invested in the American dream. This is really what the stakes are when we're talking about exactly this issue that you raise. This is why we need to be warriors for the people who are most vulnerable.
Well, Dr. Brooks, thank you so much. To our audience, if you're interested in learning more about Dr. Brooks' thoughts, his book is available, as we suggested, in the link to the notice you got of this call. Dr. Brooks, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today. I think we'll have you back again soon. We'd enjoy hearing from you again. To our audience, once again, please do join us for our next Teleforum conference call scheduled for Tuesday next week at 12 noon when we'll be talking about the greenhouse gas litigation. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you, everybody. It's been an honor to be with you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.